You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. House managers continue to lay out their case against President Trump on day three or two, depending on how you count it. People are doing it differently, of the impeachment trial in the Senate. Coming up, we'll hash out some of the latest developments. First, the 2020 presidential election is less than a year away, and voters will get to decide whether to give President Trump a second term in office. In a book that came out last year, our next guest took a closer look at how he got here with Trump's rise in the Republican Party, and he makes the case that Trump was the political outsider the country needed. Victor Davis Hanson is a senior fellow in military history at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University and professor emeritus of classics at California State University, Fresno. He's the author of dozens of books. His latest is The Case for Trump. Victor, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, as I mentioned, your book came out last year, but it's interesting to look at it now as we're in the middle of this presidential campaign. We'll dig into some of the things that you see leading to the rise of Donald Trump as a viable candidate. But do you think they're going to have the same effect now as an incumbent as they did as this out-of-nowhere outsider 4-ish years ago?
Well, the situation is markedly different, but I'm not sure it's to his disadvantage. He got elected because he made inroads in the traditional Democratic constituency, and where you are in the middle West, that was where the election was decided. And he took Democratic issues from the old Democratic issues about secure borders, less competition from foreign labor, parity with China on trade issues, promotion of energy, et cetera, and that appealed to enough voters in a way that McCain and Romney had not achieved. But now he has a record and people know him. And the question will be is to know Donald Trump intimately, not to like him, or is it more that the economy's got near record low unemployment? It's got good growth, low inflation, low interest, record energy production. And that's what the decision in the election is going to be about.
Now, looking back to the lead up to 2016, you point out, and other people have pointed out, the idea that, okay, we've got this divide in America, and that is something that helped Donald Trump win in 2016. How do you slice up that divide? What do you see as the key divide in the American political system in the last few years?
Well, I think there were people, the country had changed because of globalization, and the coast and the area, some areas around the Great Lakes, were more intricately connected to the global economy, and people that were in technology or law or the media, insurance, investments, finance, did pretty well because their market went from 300 million to 7 billion. And those whose labor could be Xeroxed or their products could be Xeroxed abroad more cheaply, they didn't do so well. And that was the root of the fissure, and had been going on for most of the 21st century as outsourcing and offshoring increased. The difference with Trump is that the traditional Republican Party had not addressed that. They had believed in sort of Hayek's creative destruction, that the market would adjudicate, and if somebody lost a job in a lathe in Milwaukee, then he better go to get in the pickup truck and drive to the Dakotas to frack or learn coding. And Trump said, no, we've got cheaper energy, we've got a better system, we've got better workers, why are we not building things that are now outsourced to China or Japan or South Korea? And so that argument was pretty appealing. And to defeat him, I think the Democrats were going to have to say that unemployment went up, or GDP went down, or energy fracking and horizontal drilling has to cease because of climate change, or we shouldn't build a wall, or the borders should be more porous. And those are the issues that are going to be in contentions. And some of them, like the New Green Deal or reparations or Medicare for All, don't poll 51%. And I think there's some unease on the Democratic side that there's a foreshadowing of the 1972 or 1984 election, where they're letting their hearts rather than their heads drive them. Because I think by most pundits and analysts think that Joe Biden probably has the best chance of carrying the Middle West over Trump. And yet it's not at all sure that the party base will embrace that realism.
Talking to Victor Davis Hanson, a senior fellow in military history at the Hoover Institution, author of the book "The Case for Trump." Now, Victor, you have studied a lot of ancient Greek history. You have a lot of references to that throughout your book. But one of my favorite references, and it's one that had been in my head, was to the 1980 movie Caddyshack. In some ways, the president's personality and him up against Hillary Clinton, you see as this Caddyshack election, which for people who haven't seen it was kind of your basic snobs versus slobs. You had kind of the old guard, rich people, and the Rodney Dangerfields of the world. How do you think that sort of that personality played out in the 2016 election?
Well, I mean, I think half the country found him off-putting and half of him found him authentic. And so when Donald Trump came out to California, and the few times he did out here in rural California, I asked people who went to his fundraising, I said, did he put the straw in the mouth? Did he get the drawl? Did he wear the caterpillar cap? And they said, no, he came out with this weird Queens accent and very hot day with a black suit and spiffy shoes. And the point that I'm making is whatever he was that way everywhere. It was very unlikely that, you know, he would be like Hillary Clinton and go to the South or to a black American audience and say, I'm so tired. Or Joe Biden, who faked that accent with, I'm put you all in chains. So there was a sense that he was a Rodney Dangerfield authentic character, even though that entailed being crass and boorish. People wanted that. And it was also sort of like they wanted a revenge on the bipartisan establishment. It was as if he was a pit bull and they cut the leash and they just said, go in that direction and those people deserve whatever they get. There was an anger there as well.
Something that struck me in the run-up to the election, from where I'm sitting as a talk show host, callers who supported Bernie Sanders in the Democratic primary and said they would seriously consider voting for Trump if Hillary Clinton won that. And policy-wise, they're very far apart on many issues, maybe not trade, but there's something there, that outsider, that somebody, as you were saying, who's going to challenge the orthodoxy of both parties.
There was also the economic reality that if you get up in Michigan or Pennsylvania or here where I'm speaking in rural California, and you know how to drive a Caterpillar or you know how to drive a tractor or a forklift or you work in an assembly plant, the wages that you were getting and the job security that you were supposedly assured wasn't there to create the type of lifestyle that your parents had. So Trump came along and made that argument that and he made it in cultural terms that people had neglected the hollowed out Midwest and the interior of the country, not just for economic reasons, but because they were connected more with London and Paris and Beijing and Seoul and Tokyo and cared more about getting rich in that global mercantile system than they did worrying about fellow Americans. And there was cultural elements to it. You know, they were the deplorables, the irredeemables. I think Biden called them at one point the dregs of society, and that became a badge of honor. So it was almost a pushback against San Francisco and Wall Street and Harvard and Hollywood, coastal institutions that really had an inordinate amount of influence. I think sometimes people in those areas think, well, we produce the movies, we produce the sitcoms, we produce the evening news, we produce the radio, we push the TV, the print, we produce the investments, and we produce your apps, your internet, your social media, and therefore we have all this influence. And a lot of people were saying, not numerically you don't, surely not in the Electoral College you don't. So that was sort of what the election in 2016 was about, I think.
We're talking to Victor Davis Hanson with Stanford University. He's with us to talk about his latest book, The Case for Trump. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a supporter of the president? You're already on board without needing a new case for Trump. What are some of the president's achievements in office that stand out to you that you think should be highlighted in 2020? If you're critical of Trump's presidency, what do you say about some of the things he's gotten done? What is it that puts him off or puts you off when it comes to the president? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. From wherever you're sitting in the political spectrum, what would it take, do you think, for a Democrat to beat him come November? We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our talk with Victor Davis Hanson. We're talking about his book, The Case for Trump. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Whether you support Trump or not, are there things he's done throughout his presidency that you've liked? Do you think he should get a second term in office? Why not? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll go to your calls now. Dennis is with us in Two Rivers. Dennis, hi.
Hi. I figure with Trump, it's the halo effect. Some people figure since Trump is in favor of some important issues, they won't believe anything bad about Trump because of those particular issues.
Dennis, thanks for the call. Victor, yeah. do you think that once people have supported Donald Trump, they're on board for whatever else he brings to the table?
No, I think if the caller means that they go down a list of 10 or 12 issues and they say which one is more likely to reflect my own views. So do we want to frack and horizontally drill and be the chief oil producer in the world, or we want to outlaw the Green New Deal? Do we want a wall, or do we want open borders? Do we want ICE, or do we want to abolish it? Do we want Medicare for people over 62 or for everybody? They go down systematically and they come to a decision, and about half say that they prefer the alternative to Trump on those issues, and the other half say, you know what, that he's better than the alternative. But I don't think that I do think that the Democratic field is more radical than it has been the last two or three elections. And so they feel that Trump is an obstacle to that agenda. And they like that, half the country. And I think the other half, some of the Democrats, if we see from the polling, are not quite on board with the rhetoric of progressivism. By that, I mean, the most radical candidates, Kamala Harris or Cory Booker or Julian Castro, they didn't do well. And some of the older white males didn't do well. But nonetheless, the Democratic Party has an existential problem that the people on that stage were mostly older and white. And that wasn't the constituency that the rhetoric of the campaign was promoting.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We'll go now to Heidi in Madison. Heidi, hello.
Hi. I am a supporter. I'll be honest. I don't agree with everything he does, for instance, his tweeting. But by and large, I mean, we've got the best economy since we've had, you know, what, since the 1960s? More people are employed, varying groups of people since the 1950s or 60s. And I disagree with the previous caller about the oil. I mean, I think the fact that we are fuel independent, I think that's critical. We no longer have to depend on the Middle East. You know, we can.
I agree entirely, and I think it's already translated into a new strategic policy in the Middle East that we're not wedded to intervening, because we don't need the oil or the gas, and our ally Israel doesn't need the oil or the gas anymore. Europe and China surely do, and they're going to have more interest in keeping the sea lanes and those countries stable. So it's freed us in that sense from strategic liabilities. And of course, it's kept the price down, and it's hurt our enemies that are oil producers like Iran and Russia. So I think most Americans say, you know what, we have an open mind in climate change, and by all means, let's get solar panels and everything. But for the next half century, let's produce all the gas and oil we can and be independent.
Heidi, thanks for that call. President Obama had gotten some criticism from environmental groups for pointing out that oil and gas production had gone up during his term and taking some credit for that, or trying to take some credit for that. Does President Trump get credit for some things that were maybe processes going on already when he came into office?
I think he accelerated it. I think Obama, remember that Obama canceled all federal leasing, new federal leasing on federal lands, and contrast, Trump opened them up. He opened ANWR up. Obama would have never done that. He green-lighted the Keystone and the other pipeline projects. He increased offshore leasing. So I think economically, Obama just kept things sort of status quo, but he wasn't an active promoter of gas and oil. And he couldn't be because of the base of his party. But Trump found no such resistance, and by nature and inclination, he wanted to produce as much as possible. And that explains why we've gone up about 3 million barrels a day since Trump was elected.
Thanks again for your call, Heidi. We'll go now to Mary in Pewaukee. Mary, hi.
Yes, hi. Well, I completely disagree with your guest. And one of the things he said about Democrats or progressives dealing with their hearts instead of their minds, but part of that's true. We deal with our heart and we have empathy, unlike the administration that's in now. But it's also proven fact that most Democrats are the college educated or people that have knowledge. And that's why a lot of people think that Wisconsin Public and National Public Radio do lean left. It's because they have the experts on that actually have the knowledge. And that another thing is that all of the things that he's bringing up, that Trump is supposedly good, we don't want more oil and gas produced. We want to get away from that and worry or take care of the global warming and climate change.
Mary, I'm going to jump in. You gave us a lot to work with there. Victor, one point she made saying, hey, the Democrats have it right. They have the support of the college educated and the experts. So that's, I think a Republican listening would say, yeah, that's why Democrats in part are wrong, because they think of themselves that way.
I'm not even sure that that's correct. I think there was a survey of CNN and Fox viewers, and there was no difference in educational level or knowledgeable level.
So right, but the self-perception, I think, that she was making the case for.
Yeah, that's a self. As far as the heart and head, she misinterpreted what I said. I was talking about as just a realist point of view that if you look at the polls, most people rationally in the Democratic Party would probably go with Biden, but he's not the spiritual favorite, so to speak, Elizabeth Warren or Bernie, and that was true of McGovern and Mondale as well when they ran. It's just an observation. I'm not, as far as being more empathetic, well, that's just a value judgment that each different party privileges over the opposite.
Thanks again for that call. Victor Davis Hanson is with us talking about his book, The Case for Trump. Back to your calls. Janice is with us in Milwaukee. Janice, hello.
Hello.
Yeah, what did you want to bring up, Janice?
Well, you know, I'm more concerned about Trump's moral values and how he projects himself to the country and the world. And I would like to see us get back to the values in the country and the fact that he's racist and he lies. Everybody knows he's a liar, and I don't know what Republicans. I know Republicans want to stay in control, and so they go along with it. But that's my concern.
Janice, thanks a lot for the call, Victor. Some common criticisms of the president there.
Well, I mean, he's obviously can be crass, but when he says he's a liar, what does that mean? Did he say that you can keep your doctor and your health plan to sell Medicare, or did he tell us the truth about the entire Iran deal? All presidents fudge on the truth. It's just a fact. As far as his morals, a lot of that is the age of social media and internet. If I said to your caller, which president unzipped his pants and exhibited himself to his cabinet officers, or I said, which president had sex with an intern who was 18 in the swimming pool? Nobody would say John F. Kennedy and LBJ respectively. So that was a phenomenon. We did not have an intrusive press. We didn't have social media. We didn't have the internet. But I mean, by my God, I really kind of resent that call, because FDR was conducting an affair while he was in the White House, using his daughter as an intermediary, Anna, and yet he was a good president. So I opposed the impeachment of Bill Clinton, but I thought his conduct was reprehensible. But I don't think Trump is doing any of that. I think that his sin is that he replies in kind with Megyn tonnage. He's reactive when people attack him. Then he disproportionately answers back, and sometimes he uses phrases that we all would like him not to, mini Mike or sleazebag, et cetera. But as far as his personal comportment, I think the caller needs to take a lesson in American presidential history. And I think she'd be really surprised about what type of people have been in the White House. Dwight Eisenhower saved the U.S. coalition, but he was probably conducting an affair with Kay Summersby while he was running the Normandy campaign. George Patton saved thousands of lives, but he probably had an affair with his stepniece. I'm not condoning that. I'm just trying to offer a little balance or realism about what leadership is.
Thanks for the call, Janice. In our last few moments, I want to have you address one particular, I think, not super powerful contingency constituency at this point, the so-called Republican never-Trumpers. There are some here in Wisconsin. They had a last-ditch effort in the primaries trying to be a roadblock to President Trump. What would you say to those who say, hey, we're Republicans, we're conservative, and we think Donald Trump has abandoned our principles?
I think they're fair to have that point. I would remind them, though, that the latest poll shows that no president in recent history has a higher percentage of Republican support than Donald Trump. And their loud advocacy in the 2016 election had no perceivable effect on the outcome. And so I think what's happening now is they're sort of in an echo chamber, and they feel that Trump is like an eggshell. If they just tap one more time, louder, angrier, then the whole facade shell is going to collapse. And there's no evidence that that's going to happen. And then more finally, they have a paradox. They're suffering from a paradox because many of the positions that they held for their lifetime, whether it was moving the embassy to Jerusalem or matters of the Middle East, opposing the Iran deal or energy production, whatever the issue was, suddenly they were orphaned from that issue, and they rejected it because Trump's fingerprints were on it. And that a lot of people who were looking at that said, wait a minute, I heard you last year or 2 years ago give this strong advocacy, and suddenly now you've renounced your whole ideological architecture because you don't like Trump's comportment or his voice or whatever it is, or his conduct. But that's hard to get over, I think, for most people.
Victor, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Victor Davis Hanson, Senior Fellow in Military History at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. He's the author of multiple books. He was with us today to talk about one of his latest, The Case for Trump. Coming up, we'll get you up to speed on what's happening in day three of President Trump's impeachment trial. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7:30 on The Morning Show, there's been an increase in a lesser-known respiratory infection for babies. Find out about the viral illness called RSV, as well as flu and other risks for newborns and infants. It's tomorrow morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. Now, the U.S. Senate is hearing a second day of arguments against President Trump in his impeachment trial. Democratic House managers, including Jerry Nadler, are focusing on Trump's alleged abuse of power.
No president has ever used his office to compel a foreign nation to help him cheat in our elections. Prior presidents would be shocked to the core by such conduct.
Abuse of power is one of the two articles of impeachment approved by the House last month. They're scheduled to focus on the other one, obstruction, tomorrow. Trump is accused of withholding military aid to Ukraine to pressure them into investigating former Vice President Joe Biden and his son Hunter, who served on the board of a Ukrainian gas company. Trump says there was no pressure and that everything was on the level. He tweeted this morning that the Obama administration withheld aid to many countries, including Ukraine. David Schultz is a professor of political science and law at Hamline University and professor of law at the University of Minnesota. David, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me again.
What do you think so far of the case that the Democratic House managers are making that President Trump abused his power?
Well, first off, they're following very closely, and it's no surprise, the briefs in the written record they produced in the House Judiciary Committee, and again in the briefs they filed with the Senate. But what's really impressed me, especially I would say with both Nadler and Adam Schiff, is methodically how they're going through sort of point by point and fact by fact in terms of trying to make their case. Again, speaking as a law professor, I know when I was listening to Jerry Nadler, Representative Nadler this morning, he was saying what they were going to do was first explain the law, then explain the facts, and then apply the facts to the law. This is kind of classic law school approach to how to prosecute a case or how to make your case. When I say classic law school, I don't mean that in the bad sense. That's a classic way to do it, and that's what they've been doing. They've been slowly and methodically laying out the facts in a very compelling way in terms of making their argument.
Maybe a classic prosecution. It's not a classic courtroom. It's the Senate, though, and some Republican senators are saying, hey, this is, you guys are taking too long. You're repeating the same things again and again. There's nothing new. Even if this is a good court approach, given the audience, is this something that may not be effective?
Ultimately, most of us are thinking it's not going to be effective in the sense that there's very few of us who are thinking, or very few of anybody who are thinking that the 67 votes are going to be there to convict the president of the United States. So instead, the question becomes, you know, why are the Democrats laying out in the way that they're doing it here? And I think in part is this is laying it out for the court for public opinion, you know, that they're trying to educate the American public. And let's be kind of honest here in the sense that the public is not going to be glued to their television set, you know, 12 hours a day, every day. People are going to be kind of maybe tuning in, tuning out to their TVs, to their radios. And I think part of why the House is doing this is to sort of keep repeating this. So as people zone in, zone out, as even senators, and we're noticing this yesterday especially, that the senators aren't observing their decorum in terms of paying attention, that by repeating it enough times, it starts to sink in for the public and maybe a few senators.
Last night, lead manager Adam Schiff said as the trial goes on, expect more proof of wrongdoing by Trump to emerge.
Evidence continues to be produced. The truth is going to come out. Indeed, the truth has already come out, but more and more of it will. More emails are going to come out. More witnesses are going to come forward. They're going to have more relevant information to share. And the only question is, do you want to hear it now? Do you want to know the full truth now?
And one example of that, Lev Parnas in interviews and releasing documents and pictures, a lot of things adding pieces to this puzzle. But the question, or one big question here is, does the Senate care about new stuff, David, or are we frozen at time when the House voted on these articles of impeachment?
Well, I think the answer is yes to both of those questions here, in the sense that I don't think additional information changes the Senate's mind. There's very little political incentive for Republican senators, for 20 of them especially, to change their minds and go along with the Democrats. And I say that because at the end of the day, when Trump has support of about 90% of the Republican Party, it would be very hard to go against him. Plus, on top of which, there's an interesting Pew poll that just came out, I think in the last 24 hours, that pointed out and said that, well, not an insubstantial percentage of Republican voters think what the president did was wrong. They still don't support removing him from office. So, again, it would be very, very difficult to get these Republican senators to change their minds. But where Adam Schiff is making a good point here, and I think this is also a danger for the Republicans, if the Senate trial looks completely like a sham, if it doesn't look like they've actually taken it seriously, to what extent does this hurt hurt both Donald Trump, but more importantly, does it hurt senators up for election this coming year when there are 35 Senate races, of which 23 are Republicans? And again, the Pew poll is suggesting that a majority of Americans do want to see, actually it's a significant majority, I think it's like 70%, do want to have witnesses, do want to have a full trial in the sense of hearing all the information. So there's a real danger or risk here with the Republicans of trying to sort of rush this through and short-circuit the process.
David Schultz is with us from Hamline University looking at the latest on impeachment. Let's take a look at the next step of this abuse of power. Part one, as you said, was laying out the facts. Part two is establishing that if these facts are agreed on, it's impeachable. Now, Republicans have said Trump's actions don't amount to a crime, a high crime. Nadler used a 20-year-old clip of Lindsey Graham explaining what he thought the founders meant by high crimes. Here's a listen to that, the two of them.
And I might say the same thing of then-House manager Lindsey Graham, who in President Clinton's trial flatly rejected the notion that impeachable offenses are limited to violations of established law. Here is what he said.
What's a high crime? How about if an important person hurts somebody of low means? It's not very scholarly, but I think it's the truth. I think that's what they meant by high crimes. Doesn't even have to be a crime. It's just when you start using your office and you're acting in a way that hurts people, you've committed a high crime.
As it happens, I gather Graham had stepped out of the chamber when that clip was played. But this is a key issue here. Do you have to break a statutory law? Do you have to commit a criminal act under the criminal code to constitute a high crime worthy of impeachment?
The answer is no. Both the historical evidence from the framers and from legal scholars almost consistently have indicated that a real crime does not actually have to be committed. But having said that, there is at least one allegation of a real crime here. The obstruction of Congress could actually be construed as a real crime. For example, if you or I or any of the listeners were subpoenaed by Congress asked to show up and testify, and if we refused to do so, that could constitute contempt of Congress under some scenarios, or if we tried to prevent Congress from doing its job. Additionally, there was right before the trial started, there was a Congressional Budget Office report that came out, and the Democrats are referring to it, saying that the withholding of the money to Ukraine violated the 1974 Budget and Empowerment Act. So there are allegations out there, possibilities of real crimes being committed. But no, both the framers and historical evidence and scholars have pretty much reached the consensus that a real crime does not have to be committed. Now, it may not be exactly what Lindsey Graham said back in that tape, but a high crime and misdemeanor historically has included, among other things, maladministration, misadministration, misuse of power, abuse of power, and so it's a very broad term that at the end of the day, the House and the Senate have to make a political judgment on regarding whether or not the actions of the president constitute something that is so serious that it rises to removal from office.
Now, speaking of Republican Senator Lindsey Graham, he talked to reporters this morning and said he wants people to hear about Hunter Biden's dealings with Ukraine and, by extension, then Vice President Joe Biden. Here's a listen to some of what he had to say.
Does it make sense to hire the son of the guy in charge of the portfolio for the American government? And from the time they raided the president's home, Joe Biden called the president of the Ukraine four times, got on a plane, and said, if you don't fire this guy, you don't get the $1 billion. I love Joe Biden, but I can tell you, if the name was Trump, there'd be a lot of questions asked.
So he indicated also he doesn't want this trial to turn into a circus, so he would want to look into the Bidens separately. What do you make of his talk about the Bidens there?
Couple of things. First off, as several people have pointed out, the story about the Bidens has been examined several times and largely has been discredited in terms of any crimes having been committed. The second thing that I think the Democrats are trying to argue, and they've actually been making that point, and they're going to be making that point, I think, more. But the second thing is that one generally can't escape responsibility for one's actions by pointing to somebody else and say they did something wrong and that therefore excuses me. And I think that's what the Democrats are also going to start to make an argument more on, is that whatever may be the case with Biden, although they are saying he didn't do anything wrong, it doesn't excuse what the President of the United States did in this situation here.
We're talking about today's developments in the Senate impeachment trial for President Trump. David Schultz is with us, political science and law professor at Hamline University, law professor at the University of Minnesota, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of this Senate trial so far? Are Democrats, do you think, doing a good job of laying out their case against President Trump, or do you think it's a non-starter? What do you want Republican senators, Democratic senators to consider as they weigh these two articles of impeachment? Do you have a question about what the heck's going on here? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about the ongoing impeachment trial against President Trump. David Schultz is with us from Hamline University, and you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. How closely are you following the impeachment trial? What do you think of the case House managers are making? If you are following it closely, what do you want to come out of this? Should the president be removed from office in this impeachment process or not? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go to our callers now. Tom is with us in Port Wing. Tom, hi.
Hi. I would like to see witnesses, but I'm going to explain why I believe no witnesses will ever be called. And if possible, I could get a follow-up with your guest. The reason I believe no witnesses will ever be called is simply because all Republicans and all Democrats are involved in exactly what Joe Biden was doing with family members and friends and neighbors. And that's why they all know what the other senators, which is in a good old boys club, which Senator Joe Biden was a member of, and they have no intention of exposing all of this. That's why I believe no witnesses will ever be called.
Tom, thanks for the call. David, what do you think? They all maybe benefit from, or their relatives benefit, he says, from getting a cozy deal sometimes just because of their status.
Well, clearly we can raise, I think, serious questions about, let's say, conflicts of interest and ethics of members of the Senate. And I think that's a legitimate discussion here. But I'm going to sort of bracket that off to the side and say, I also agree, though, with the caller that I think it's highly unlikely that witnesses will be called. And I say that because this impeachment trial is incredibly risky for everybody. Senate Republicans, Donald Trump, House Democrats, no one knows where it's going to go. And the introduction of witnesses, I think, especially for Trump and for the Republicans, changes the variables in terms of what could possibly happen. And so because of that, I would say that's the reason why we're not going to see the witnesses. The issue about, let us say, again, ethics of Senate members, that may be a whole different topic.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Rob is with us in Wausau. Rob, hi.
Hi. You say that the Bidens were investigated in their dealings with Ukraine, but we've never heard anything about this investigation. We hear every day something different they're investigating Trump about, and the details right down to the nitty-gritty. Is this just a whitewash that the Bidens didn't do anything wrong and they were found to not have done anything wrong? Why don't we hear any public details about this?
Rob, thanks for the call. What do we know about the Bidens, and how do we know what we know, I guess, David?
Okay, what we largely know about them is a couple, you know, is based upon Department of Justice investigations, you know, which looked at some of these, but looked at some of these allegations about them, as well as, I believe, but don't, I may not be certain on this one, in terms of there might have been some examination through Congress or one of the other executive agencies, but actually it has been looked at. And has been largely dismissed in terms of let's say, illegality. Now, whether it was a smart idea for Hunter Biden to be on that board when his father was vice president, that may be a different question. There may be an ethical issue here, but were there any laws broken? No. Was there any evidence that Vice President Biden intervened in any way to stop any investigations by Ukraine? The answer is no. So all that has largely been examined and been dismissed. The perpetuation of the story is largely a myth.
Thanks for that call, Rob. And getting back to that Lindsey Graham clip we heard about Joe Biden putting pressure to get a prosecutor fired and using some American aid as a backup for that. This was a prosecutor who was known for not pursuing corruption, including against companies like Burisma, where Hunter Biden was on the board. Is that right?
That is absolutely correct.
All right. Thanks again for the call, Rob. Still time for you to join in at 800-642-1234. We've also seen the Democrats more recently talk about the other part or another part of the president's phone call with the then new president of Ukraine, talking about Ukrainian concerns about Ukrainian election interference, supposedly in the 2016 election. Democrats saying that's a discredited line of argument. Is that something you expect to see much focus on, David?
I will see probably the Republicans bringing that up, because what the Republicans will offer, I think, is part of their defense, is to say that the reason why Donald Trump raised the questions about doing the investigations of Biden and of doing some investigations, regarding, let us say, possible corruption, is to find out whether or not the Ukrainian government, as opposed to the Russian government, or maybe with the Russian government, tried to interfere in U.S. elections. And again, this is largely, I think, both the Mueller report as well as House and Senate committees, which looked at the 2016 election, reached pretty much a unanimous conclusion that it was the Russian government or Russian operatives that tried to interfere in U.S. elections, and there's no credible evidence that Ukraine tried to do that.
We're talking to David Schultz from Hamline University, looking at the latest on impeachment. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are you watching for in the remainder of today and then tomorrow, David?
What I'm looking for today, again, is in sense of how they now connect the factual situations of what Trump did to both supporting it, and they already have, and they're going to try to come up with multiple ways of reaching the same conclusion to say this is factually what we know, and then now making the case as to why this rises to the level of a high crime and misdemeanor. Because it's not enough just for him to say this is bad, which their argument's going to be, is say this is what he did, was bad. They have to make the argument to say it is so significant that it rises to what our framers thought was that high crime and misdemeanor. So that's what I'm going to be looking for, is to see how they sort of, if I can use that old phrase, how they connect the dots in terms of the connection between the constitutional language and the factual arguments that they're laying out today.
Time for one more caller. Cole is with us in Sun Prairie. Cole, hello.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to call and comment about the Hunter Biden thing one last time, because the previous callers that I've heard now and their concerns and questions about it are just kind of driving me nuts. Your screen caller did correct me in that our intelligence agencies have disproved a lot of things, or the Ukraine conspiracy theory about interfering in our election. But I believe that it's also been stated publicly by officials that the Hunter Biden narrative is just that. It's a narrative being perpetuated by Russians and through Fox media and propaganda. It's maddening that that is even still a concern or an issue from people when it has very clearly...
Cole, I'm going to jump in. We're just about out of time. David, Cole worried that if we're talking about Hunter Biden, we're talking about somebody's particular talking points to distract from the impeachment, in effect.
Yeah, and that's President Putin did raise that when accused, Russia was accused of interfering, and that sort of becomes the talking point that, again, as the caller is saying here, a distraction or a counter theory to try to justify the president's phone call.
Thanks, David, for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Anytime. Thank you very much.
That's David Schultz, professor of political science and law at Hamline University, professor of law at the University of Minnesota. Joined us today for a look at the latest in President Trump's impeachment trial. Day four gets underway tomorrow. The Trump legal team begins its opening arguments coming up on Saturday. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, House Democrats, as we say, wrap up their case to the U.S. Senate tomorrow. We'll get an update on the latest and look ahead at that likely Republican response. The English documentary series 7 Up started interviewing people at age 7 and then again every 7 years. They're now 63, and one of them is here in Wisconsin. We'll find out what it's like to live under a unique long-term spotlight. And it's Food Friday. We'll talk to the author of the new cookbook, Nothing Fancy. That and more tomorrow on Central Time.